Welcome, everybody. So we have several guests with us tonight, and first of all, welcome. We're so happy you're here, all of you, all of us. So under the circumstances, I'll take a little time to sort of give some context for what we do here every Thursday night in the name of, not in the name of ourselves, but in the name of Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi and an ancient lineage going back to the prophets. Rumi is a wide open door for humanity. A lot of people have been entering that door in recent decades. A sense, a quality of humanness in him that is also sublime and reminds us of what we could become. During his own time, he was practiced, of course, the path of Islam, and at the same time welcomed all kinds of people to his circle. Maybe he understood the deep meaning of a verse in the Quran that says, "Do not be among those who break religion into sects, each rejoicing in what it alone has." Our understanding of this context and this path is that it's something very universal, very broad. We see a whole landscape of prophets that have been sent to humanity. We, I think, name about 26 of them in the Quran and countless others unnamed, including even, of course, even indigenous communities. So this is our universe, this is Rumi's universe, and also love was very central to his teaching. Not an emotional love, not a love that wishes to possess anything, but as he said, the highest love is love which has no object. When you yourself become the love and just, you know, radiate it. And in the Sufi tradition, our main concern, our focus, is really transformation of the human being. That's what it's all about. You know, we don't ignore the outer world. In fact, we're really obliged to be part of it and to contribute to it. But what we talk about here is the process of transformation, about what we learn about ourselves, what we observe in ourselves, because, all right, for starters, the divine is infinite and beautiful and absolutely amazing. But we also have another factor, which is the human ego, or nafs, which tends to kind of monopolize a lot of our consciousness. So we're learning how to diminish the soul's preoccupation with the ego, we call it nafs, and to purify the heart in order to be able to remember God more continually through an awakened heart that senses, it's very simply for us, remembrance, which is called zikr, zikr Allah, remembrance of God, is the heart's perception that we're in a divine reality. And the more we know that, the more everything changes. The less fear we have, the more trust we have. The easier it is to just let go of certain things. And in that openness to the divine, well, then the divine can do some work on us. We can't do very much but clear the space and invite the grace, the help, the guidance of the divine. So, many weeks here we'll be talking about, typically, we'll be talking about matters of the practicalities of this process. It's a very practical process. And the process would be the same for anybody, whether they call themselves a believer or an agnostic. It's actually really interesting to communicate with people who consider themselves even atheists or agnostic. And the labels, yeah, I mean, don't mean so much. What matters is, are we willing to change? Are we willing to undergo this transformation? Are we willing to engage in that process that allows the ego to diminish and the heart to come forth? So somebody might ostensibly call themselves an atheist and be more committed to that transformation than somebody who thinks they're very religious but is unwilling to change. And, so that's the context, and for us our lineage is the lineage of Rumi. We are really grateful for this, because with Rumi we not only have what I'll call an awareness of the pure primordial tradition of humanity, the pure prophetic, Abrahamic, universal tradition that seeks to know the truth. But we also have with Rumi a spiritual genius of incredible creativity and imagination, who took, you might say, the DNA of revelation and let it unfold, let it blossom into a beautiful garden, a whole living kingdom of meaning. And that creativity and spirituality is such a beautiful thing. It's a shame when any framework, religious or otherwise, reduces things to black and white or even shades of gray, when in fact the Creator, the creative power, created a universe of such beauty and diversity and creativity. And so this is the extraordinary gift of Rumi, absolutely centered in the simple primordial truth that has to do with our absolute need for God, or if you like, if you prefer, for truth, for the real, absolute recognition of our dependence, our need for the real, as opposed to the humanly conceived, the false, the imaginary. And at the same time, giving it to us with such extraordinary beauty and nuance, and sometimes humor. So, many weeks here we might be discussing presence, awareness, human will, conscious choice, intentionality, things like that, that are, you might say, terms of an applied spirituality, almost psychological in their language. Tonight is a little bit different by chance, because tonight is the birthday of Hazrat-e Ali, one of the closest companions of the Prophet, and one of the key links in the chain of transmission of Sufism. He was the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, and it's through him that this hidden tradition, not so hidden, let's call it a hidden living tradition of mysticism has come down from the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, through Hazrat-e Ali, also called Imam Ali, and down through generations to Rumi, and then eventually down here to 1288 Cherokee Road, Louisville, Kentucky, 2014. Alhamdulillah, praise be to God. And so this is a special night, a special time. Some of our friends in different places, in different countries, are celebrating this tonight. And you're going to hear some of the words of Ali. May God be pleased with him. I'm sure God is pleased with him. Now, what was extraordinary about Ali was that, maybe we don't need this slide right now. Many things were extraordinary about him, but one was his courage, extraordinary courage. At the end of book one of Rumi's Masnavi is a story about Ali in battle, because he was also really one of the greatest swordsmen, and incidentally, one of the greatest calligraphers. Mm-hmm. Some kind of relationship there, I think. And also, one of the greatest orators ever in Arabic. His gift of language, as with Muhammad as well, I mean, in their spoken word, apart from the revelation, these people were, you know, the epitome of beautiful, articulate language with an economy of words. So you'll hear some of his words tonight. I think it's enough that we just feel Ali's presence and reflect on some things that are said about him and some things that he himself said. You'll see they're often very, very practical, undeniably true human advice, the advice you could give to your children, to yourself, to any human being, really. They're not dependent on some kind of belief system, because they are just the truth. You only have to believe in truth. That's quite enough. And but even before we get there, so there are two pages to share. Everybody should take two pages. Two for you, two for me, and two for everybody. Let's go in these two directions.
Maybe if we just turn the overhead light up a little bit and not use it.
If you prefer.
So maybe people can see a little bit.
Kasim, could you turn up that light a bit for everybody? I thought I was putting in a smaller bulb here, but it's as bright as all the other ones I put in. I feel like we can't, it's in mentioning Ali, we really need to go one step back and consider Prophet Muhammad. first. You can't just jump to Ali without a word about Muhammad coming from Rumi, from the discourses of Rumi. Because this beautifully expresses Rumi's own sentiments about this. Hopefully, I don't know how many people we have here tonight. I have printed 20 some sheets.
I think George needs it. Yeah.
George. And you guys.
Is there. Yeah? Do we have one more? Or are we. Is an extra? Oh, great. Perfect.
See? Any of you who don't actually have one of these can walk away with ours. But it was a pretty good guess. I didn't really know who was coming tonight. I didn't expect all of you. But Camille, would you read to us Manifest Signs?
It's strange for you to have a state in which there is no room for Muhammad, when Muhammad does not have a state in which there is no room for a creature like you. After all, the state you have attained is because of him and through his influence. All gifts are first showered down upon him, only then are they distributed through him to others. Such is the custom. God said, "Peace be with you, O Prophet, and God's mercy. We shower you with all gifts." The Prophet added, "And upon God's righteous servants." God's way was extremely terrifying and blocked by snow. Since the Prophet risked his life, first to drive his horse forward in order to clear the way, whoever goes this way does so because of his guidance and favor. He first discovered the way, leaving signposts everywhere to say, "Do not go this way, do not go that way, and if you go that way, you will perish like the people of Ad and Thamud. And if you go this way, you will find salvation like the faithful." The whole Quran expresses this one thing. Therein are manifest signs. That is, we have put signposts along these routes. If anyone intends to tear down any of these posts, everyone will set upon him and say, "Why are you ruining our route? Are you trying to get us killed? Are you a highwayman?" Now realize that the leader is Muhammad. Until one reaches Muhammad, one does not reach us.
Yeah, so I thought you'd be interested in hearing these words from Rumi. And just by way of explanation, Rumi heard from his own beloved teacher, master, friend, Shamsi Tabriz, who said, I can quote or paraphrase these extraordinary words. He said, "We owe," and let me also contextualize this in saying, nobody pretends that the way to God only came into existence with Muhammad, because we know there's a whole history of revelation and that there are many legitimate ways to the divine. That's without doubt. But what's being spoken about here is a particular path to the divine that is real, that has its own grace, its own power, its own energy, its own love. It has a reality in the unseen. So Shamsi Tabriz said to Rumi, when he was teaching me, he said, "We owe so much to the Prophet Muhammad, who opened a way when there wasn't one. He rode his horse, you know, through all these, speaking figuratively, through all of these obstacles, and opened up the path for us, the way. He said he's the kind of man before whom even angels lay down their ladders. He said, even acrobats who astound people on a high wire with amazing feats are amazed at the length and the strength of Muhammad's rope. And anyone who has ever seen the Prophet Muhammad riding upon a huge black lion and cropping it as if it were a lazy donkey can only fall down in admiration of him. So that was how Shamsi Tabriz, who transformed Rumi, who made Rumi from Jalaluddin into Mevlana, Jalaluddin Rumi, this was Shams's own love and respect for the Prophet Muhammad. And I hear echoes of Shams's words in this discourse, repeated many years later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something we feel grateful for, and I just want to remind us and really make it clear that Muhammad and Ali and Rumi, these are universal figures. The truth that they brought is a truth for humanity. And, this is not about any man-made institution or belief system. This is something else. So, now we get to some more Rumi, which will touch on Hazrati Ali. And Qasim, would you read for us?
Sure. Resurrection is
now. Yeah.
The resurrection is now. In this world, everyone is preoccupied with something. Some are preoccupied with love for women, some with possessions, some with making money, some with learning. And each one believes that his well-being and happiness depend on that. And that also is God's mercy. When a man goes after it in search and does not find it, he turns his back on it. After pausing a while, he says, that joy and mercy must be sought. Maybe I did not look enough. Let me search again. When he seeks again, he still does not find it. But he continues until the mercy manifests itself unveiled. Only then does he realize that he was on the wrong track before. God, however, has some servants who see clearly even before the resurrection. Ali said, if that veil were lifted, and I would not be more certain. By this he meant that if the shell were taken away and the day of reckoning were to appear, his certitude would not increase. His perception was like a group of people who go into a dark room at night and pray, each facing a different direction. When day breaks, they all turn themselves around, all except the one man who had been facing Mecca all night long. Since the others now turn to face his direction, why should he turn around? Those servants of God face him even during the night. They have turned away from all that is other than him. For them, the resurrection is immediate and present.
Thank you. So, what do we understand from this second selection? Don't be shy. Don't think you have to be an insightful genius. Let's just hear it paraphrased in your words. What is this talking about? Does it mean anything? Does it make any sense?
I was fascinated that he doesn't go out of his way to praise the man who was facing Mecca all night. He explains God's mercy to the one who seeks and seeks and seeks. He's going down the wrong path. Eventually, almost by happenstance, finds the right path. And he shows God's mercy to the people who were praying, facing in all different directions in the dark. That said, there was one who didn't have to turn because he was facing Mecca all night.
And that one was like Imam Ali. Mm-hmm. You know, just so that you, if anybody doesn't know, the idea of the resurrection in this tradition is that one day we, all human beings who have lived, will be resurrected in some sense. You could say with a resurrection body, with some, you know, our deeds and all of our actions will come to fruition and will. We will be resurrected in the form of our most beautiful actions. Ali is saying, I would be no more, if all the veils were lifted right now, I would be no more certain of this reality than I am already. They once asked Ali, when is the resurrection going to be? And he answered, you ask about the resurrection from the resurrection? So he was already that, in some sense. But let's hear from some other folks.
By the compassion behind the idea that it's God's mercy that people are preoccupied with things like love for women, possessions, making money, learning. I was really struck by the lack of judgment on that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we, most of us fall into that category. And it's hard not to judge ourselves and each other.
And is the mercy in that love, or is it in the whole picture described there? Because the whole, what is the whole picture in that paragraph?
Well, that being preoccupied with things that aren't the right path doesn't, it's just one part of the path.
Yeah.
And then eventually...
It becomes a means. Mm-hmm. You know. And, you know, you touched on something very important, which is absolutely at the heart of this whole tradition. It's absolutely characteristic of the Prophet Muhammad and Ali and their characters, their temperaments, and the revelation itself was about this mercy. That bottom line is, it's all mercy. And even our going astray becomes, in the end, a means to our finding our way. I mean, we may suffer by going astray, and that's a mercy too. It's the corrective. So, bottom line, it's all mercy. God, the divine reality has attributes of what we call stringency. Some would call it wrath. We'd like to call it stringency. And mercy and beauty. These two categories. But really, even the stringency is just mercy with a thin coating of stringency. It's all the action of the divine intelligence, the divine guidance, fulfilling its purpose, which is not to punish or threaten, but to reveal its beauty. Anybody else? Both of these are from Rumi's discourses. These are just his, not even his written words, these are just hanging out like we are tonight.
Yeah. So good.
So good.
You need to see the parallel between reading them as Nadi's talking about perception and like how you cultivate perception. And so like this first paragraph is like that, the process of religious perception. And yes. So you're going to have those who in the dark room just know the way to Mecca. Others, the majority of us all, are struggling. And like you're saying, the path may wind. But it's a process of tuning in that perception. And if that makes sense, it was just for me.
Yeah.
I didn't catch that first
part. Yeah, thank you, Natalie. Mm-hmm. This is a key to understanding Rumi, first of all. But it's... I think it's a key to all spirituality, though that's often obscured. The key being, it's about perception. I mean, in the end you could say it's about love, but love too is about perception. You know? When we can perceive the spiritual nature of this existence we find ourselves in, love becomes possible. Love spontaneously awakens. Likewise, if we increase our love, our perception shifts. You know, you cannot truly know somebody if you don't also, in some way, love them. Otherwise, you're projecting judgment and projecting yourself on them. But one could look at the six books of the Mesnevi and all of Rumi's poetry as being instruction to the soul on how to develop our capacity for spiritual perception in order to see what truly is. And along the way, the effect of this can be intoxicating at first. But then the teaching will tell you, but you need sobriety to contain that intoxication. You need to balance it. You need to ground it in your humanness and your human responsibilities. In ethics, in service, even in adab, spiritual courtesy. And even in beauty, which all those things should be anyway, all expressions of beauty. So Ali manifested that beauty in his calligraphy, in his speech, in his behavior, in his ethics. And it was something very, very practical, as we will find out, unless anybody wants to add anything or say any more. I mean, we could say more. Yes, George.
I'd like to ask a question.
Please.
About something that you just said a few moments ago, and now I can't language it exactly. But maybe you said something that's not really seen very often or understood very often. It's a matter of perception. That everything's perception. That's where I'm not clear if you said that or not.
I didn't say everything is perception, but go on. Is that your question?
This question is, what is the difference, say, is there a difference between perception and interpretation? See, I would think of like perception as perhaps what one element of that is what the eye is seeing. And interpretation might be a mental
good
overlaying on that.
This is a very, thank you, very important question. And it becomes an opportunity to give a little context about many things that have been unspoken, at least so far this evening, but are written about in books and will be spoken about on other nights. Let's consider what we mean by perception. First of all, we don't only mean sense perception. In fact, the whole point is the perception we're talking about is with our subtler faculties. Didn't even mention those, but the human being has a whole range of subtle faculties. Let's call them the faculties of the heart. You know, the heart knows the universe qualitatively. We have intuition. We have insight. We have a sense of meaning that can come, that is authentic and real and undistorted. On the other hand, we also learn that when it comes to interpretation, that interpretation has various ratios of distortion in it, depending on, you know, our projection, our desires, our prejudices. So there's a whole world of distortion that we're all dealing with in our perception. But, okay, there's also perception that comes from the level of ego, and there's perception that comes from the level of heart, and there's perception that comes from the level of spirit. I'm going to just give you a whole range of things to think about for the moment. There's also different planes of reality. You know, there's physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, subtle, and so forth, and unitive, so just roughly speaking. And there's each of those planes has a knowledge particular to it. So there's knowledge and presence, knowledge and perception through presence on those different planes. I hope you're getting a picture of what we're talking about now. So we have, the human being has subtle faculties. One of our teachers said, Sufism, here's a wonderful definition, Sufism is the awakening and developing of latent human capacities under divine grace and guidance. The awakening and developing of latent human capacities. They're latent because they've atrophied from disuse. You know, every time we invent, you know, some new app, we lose some quality. You know, we used to find our way around town. Now we, you know. But this has been going on for tens of thousands of years. It's not just since the iPhone. The more our intellect invents things to make life easier, very often we lose innate human capacities. And so we need certain energies, fine energies, to reawaken those latent capacities. But the key term here is under divine grace and guidance. Because, as one of our teachers said, awakening and developing latent human capacities, that actually could be a definition for occultism. You know, I mean, there are people who play around and actually, or more than play around, who develop human attributes, but do not necessarily develop them under the auspices of the divine. So under divine grace and guidance. And I asked my teacher, I said, what does that mean? He said, under the auspices of love. You know? So awakening and developing latent human capacities under the auspices of love. Beginning to get a fuller picture of what we're talking about. The human being is essentially vision. What each of us is, we are essentially vision. Yes, we have bodies and all these other things, thanks be to God, and it's good to work with the earth and all the things Wendell Berry was talking about yesterday, as he does them, with a certain mix of spiritual perception, with a certain presence of heart. That presence, that spiritual perception transforms everything. You know, you do humble tasks like gardening, chopping wood. It's different with spiritual perception. It's different when more of your faculties are awakened. And this is done through finer energies. It's done through generating finer energies that then awaken our nervous system, awaken our attributes of knowing, and life becomes more meaningful. Life becomes more vivid. Life becomes actually more of a pleasure, too. But we don't get caught in that pleasure. We don't grasp it. So your innocent question led to this, and I'm just scratching the surface. But the important thing is that we have these subtle capacities, and there are means of developing them, which include meditation, contemplation, true worship, inner silence, stilling the emotions, all of which opens a space in which these perceptions are more likely to be known. They may be there all the time, but as we're preoccupied with all the things in the first sentence there, you know, that's where our attention is, that's where our focus is. And yet a much wider space can open. And those things aren't necessarily abandoned. I mean, even the self has certain rights in this world, as long as they're kept in balance, in proportion, and expressed appropriately. We don't have to punish ourselves. We don't necessarily come closer to God by killing every human desire. You know? But to have our desires in proportion, and to have, most of all, this heart perception, and living in the context of the divine reality that changes everything in our relationship to everything. Coming back to Ali, we'll hear the wisdom of a person who attained a very high level of this. And on the one hand, his advice is the kind of advice you could give to a 7-year-old child. And at the same time, it's the kind of advice that our elders can learn from. Shall we? Any more questions? We're happy when there are questions like this.
One more clarification on what George asked. Perception would be based upon human faculties and the different levels of reality. It seemed to me that my interpretation of things to a great degree is based upon my experience, including what knowledge I've picked up. Mm-hmm. So you have the faculties and you have experience, including knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. And that's described in the first paragraph here. You know, you go up searching, you think, oh, I want whatever it is I want, and then I don't get it. Experience comes in. Right. And you settle back on, maybe I didn't want that after all, or maybe I'm going to try again, and then maybe disappointed again. You learn through experience. So the whole range of human experience is also divine mercy. And that's where we learn wisdom. Wisdom is the accumulation of human experience, which endures in the soul, and in a sense, as you know, we spent about 6 months last year on this idea, the soul as a work of art. You know, the soul being an aspect of ourselves that learns from experience when it's connected to spirit, you know, yes, the experience of the divine. The soul accumulates something, a wisdom, quality of being. So we say the soul is a work in progress. You can sell your soul, you can lose your soul, you can trade it, or you can purify it, develop it, perfect it, beautify it, most of all beautify it with the names of God, with the attributes of God. And we'll now have a sense of what a real human being is like. And let me I was going to tell you a story that comes at the end of book one of the Mesnavi. Mm-hmm. Ali is in battle. And he was invincible, and he was at the front lines when his community was being aggressed against. They were never the aggressors. And when finally permission was given to defend a community that had been driven from its homes and had lost everything, and they had suffered that, in a sense, passively, eventually permission was given to resist. And in one of these battles, Ali was just about to deliver the coup de grace to his opponent when the young man spit in his face. And Ali threw down his sword, and the young man said, "Why don't you kill me? You could have killed me just then." And Ali said, "When you spit in my face, you made me angry. And I'm not allowed to wield this sword in anger. I wield it only for the sake of justice and truth. It would have been unlawful for me to kill you in that state." And in that moment, Ali's beautiful state was reflected in the heart of this young man who himself entered that state of surrender. And this is the story Rumi chooses to end book one of the Masnavi. Ya Ali. So, now what we're going to do is, we've got this page, and we can go around the circle, starting with Farid. And there are a few lines here that run, well, makes sense, run over to a second line, but you'll figure that out. So let's just go around and let's read each of these sayings with as much heart and meaning as you can summon.
A few sayings of Hazrati Ali. The word of God is the medicine of the heart.
Lead such a life that when you die, the people may mourn you, and while you are alive, then long for your company.
Generosity hides shortcomings.
Kasim.
A man's behavior is the index of his mind.
And Bilal and Manib.
A man who praises himself displays his deficiency of intellect.
The tongue of the wise man lies behind his heart.
Barbara.
A wise enemy is better than a foolish friend.
Silence is the best reply to a fool.
Okay.
Speech is like a medicine, a small dose of which cures, but an excess of which kills.
I know that one. As a man's wisdom increases, so his desire to speak decreases.
Finding fault in others is one's greatest fault.
Haste is a species of madness.
Sarah?
Greed is perpetual enslavement.
Matthew?
Knowledge is the ornament of the rich and the riches of the poor. He who teaches you even one letter binds you with a fetter of gratitude.
Truth is bitter, but its result is sweet. Falsehood appears to be sweet, but it is poisonous in its effect.
He who does not know should not be ashamed to learn. Do not run after the world. Let the world run after you.
Safi?
he who is aware of his own faults is oblivious of faults of others. Contentment is the treasure which is never exhausted.
No relationship is stronger than the relationship that exists between man and God.
Whatever harm accrues of silence can be remedied, but whatever harm is done because of speech cannot be remedied. Farid?
It is better to restrain your desires than to stretch your hand before others.
A little that is earned because of honest labor is better than a larger amount gained through dishonest means.
Thank you. Yeah, a bit of Hasrati Ali. What?
Timely.
Timely, all of it. It doesn't get old. Maybe you can feel a little bit of Ali tonight. Company. So, Wakar, which of these touches you?
They're all so good. Man's wisdom increases, so his desire to speak decreases.
Who else has some favorites here?
Truth is bitter, but its result is sweet. Falsehood appears to be sweet, but it is poisonous in its effect.
I like that one as well. I'm wondering what he... I mean, that's quite a thing to say, truth is bitter. That something arrives and maybe we don't want to see it, we don't want to acknowledge it, it's a little difficult. But here he's saying, straight up, it's bitter. But the result is sweet. You know, it's like, does that imply that most of us don't want to hear truth? You know, I mean, where we want it to be sweet and we want it to come and be easy. And yet here's something that says, you can't move this way unless this is looked at, and it's bitter. So we want to push it back and say, well, I just need the shiny, sparkly side of spirituality, and you all can deal with that darkness stuff. You know, I mean, this is cool stuff. I mean, I love my words, cool stuff. But,
I think the truth is bitter quotation is kind of a restatement of the first paragraph of the resurrection of now, which is about walking down the wrong path, but eventually finding the way.
Haste is a species of madness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty potent, huh?
The neuroses of whatever disconnect perceived.
I have a question. It is better to restrain your desires, that's obvious, than to stretch your hand before others. That part of the
Give me.
Got it.
That's an Arab idiom, but I mean, it holds true today. It's visual.
No relationship is stronger than the relationship that exists between man and God.
Yeah, profound. Let these be seeds, you know, planted in your heart. The truth of them will become more and more real in time. Where do we go for knowledge and guidance? Go to sources you can trust and respect those sources. Don't be like Mullah Nasruddin, who was going to build a house, and he went and he asked everybody he knew to advise him on building a house, and then he set off and he worked on it and worked on it, and then he called all his friends and they all came and they were aghast. They said, "Mullah, that's not a house." And he said, "Oh really? I did what everybody said." Choose your influences carefully.
Living in the world we live in right now, greed is perpetual enslavement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sort of build our own prisons.
And these people had so little, really, you know. For those of you who don't know, who can tell us what the Prophet had at the end of his life? Safi?
I think he had a sword, he had very few things, just a bowl, about half a dozen things.
He slept on a reed mat that left an impression on his side. His pillow was a block of wood, and he left no inheritance. He said, "Prophets do not leave an inheritance."
He had everything.
So we need the inspiration of beings who have lived like this and who spoke words like these. And this is right at the heart of our tradition. This is Sufism in its most practical expression.
I remember a story of Hazrat Ali when he was the Khalifa, the ruler. If you visit him for discussion, if it is a state matter, the lamp may be on, but if you turn to private matters, he turn off the lamps. He did not want to use state resources for any other purpose. So their accountability to the Creator, to the trust, was amazing.
There was something that you said maybe a year ago that so struck me. And helped me to lift some burdens, and it has to do with greed as perpetual enslavement. I might not get this right, but it was something that you have a choice of being a slave of 18,000 masters or a servant of one. Mm-hmm. And that really helped.
That's what you were quoting, the relationship with God. What is it again?
No relationship is stronger than the relationship that exists between men and God.
It's an aspect, a corollary of that. Or vice versa.
We realize this the least. I mean, this is, I'm reading it, but internalizing it, that this relationship is stronger. So, I find myself kind of short, not thinking about this, being much more into worldly relationships and stronger with my mother, with my son, with my family, not realizing this, being ignorant of this.
Well, and to quote Hazrat Ali again, he said, "The best knowledge is that which is lived." And you know, none of us are living these things to their capacity. And but they point in a direction. Yes, Matthew?
I'm trying to say
a lot of times the strongest relationships are the ones that endure through hardship. And it's like if you've ever been really deathly sick, you know, you have enough energy to think about other things, you know, but it's like that your source of life is like the one thing that you can think about in that state. So, and sometimes the strongest relationships aren't the ones that we acknowledge outwardly in our daily actions. It's like this silent knowing, understanding, and that's what came up when you said that.
Yeah.
It's my grandmother just died the other day. So it was like that.
God bless her.
That idea, that sense of losing her faculties of speech, of sight, of thought, you know, but still, she's still alive, you know, there was something there that had to be the last thing that was there for her, you know, at the end. So, might have been under the surface throughout much of, but that's what was carrying it, that was the foundation of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What comes up for me, something we talk about a lot is making God your one care, all other cares are cared for. You know, it's that same theme, and it's so, I mean, that's so multifaceted, multi-layered, you know, I mean, that touches all parts, you know.
Yes.
That true surrendering, there's a lot to that.
Yeah, because to the heart of it, make all your cares into a single care, and God will see to all your cares.
Yeah, I mean, that's just like, you know, whatever fear, whatever concern, whatever it is, it's like ultimately it's out of our hands anyway, so, you know, there's a real, relief, and yet at the same time one has to process whatever it is that we're processing,
Yeah.
But I just love that. That's
to
the heart.
Thank you.
So I find the one-to-one connection, meditation, is where I am the shortest. So I take the other route, that trying to focus on His creation. And I see that as my shortcut. If I walk the street, walk the airport, I try to carry a smile and see if I can enlist a smile from strangers. I see them as God's creation. Going to work, going to anywhere, seeing, just watching a dog tail his wag his tail makes me so happy, because here is a happy creature. And I get such a love from the living being. So I tried and I failed to do meditation, to get up at night, and I asked for forgiveness, but I tried to watch my tongue and watch my temper.
Well, you know, you are practicing the fruits of meditation, because meditation can clear the heart and open up an inner space. But the purpose of doing that is to live in this world with full with some awareness that you are in the divine presence, you're in love's universe. And if you are learning to be aware of that context, that is a kind of meditation too. And our dear brother Abdulaziz Saeed, great Sufi in Washington, D.C., a great peace worker behind the scenes in the world, he said, spirituality is developing the widest possible context. And what I hear from you, Safi, is that you're creating that context. And you're doing all of that in God, so to speak. At least that's a direction, you know, a possibility. Maybe you're doing it just out of the kindness of your heart, which is also beautiful. The only difference being, and I don't think this is at all your case, doing it for ego satisfaction or to make yourself feel good, to be a good person and all that. Those are okay motivations. They're not the highest. But when you begin to see that, you know, you're living in this world and you see your connection with other human beings and you see them all in the divine, what a beautiful state. You know, God bless that kind of relating and opening the heart to others. And the final thing I wanted to say is that this is just a sampling, and I could have also given 150 of these, and I could have given 150 from the Prophet Muhammad, and so forth. But these are the this is the context, this is the guidance for our relationships on the path. Mysterious, invisible things going on.
In many realms.
In many realms, even on the earthly realm, in the DVD player. This is the framework for relationship in a community such as this. This is what we try to live by. And this makes life potentially very beautiful.
You know, your DVD player gave me a spiritual message earlier this evening. I was looking over at you and I saw past you and it just said, stop.
Yeah, it's everything is a sign, right? Right, Bobber? Nothing but the signs of God wherever we look. And again, that's spiritual, that, you know, a modest example of spiritual perception, Barry. Bravo. Thank you for sharing it.